Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author had traveled to Southern California to investigate the concept of the backyard wildlife habitat. We resume Suburban Safari on page 216 with episode 21. On a hilltop in Alpine, I'm reminded who I am. I'm evolving into a natives freak. Don Hoemer, who lives on the hilltop, is another gardener. He's an amateur botanist, completely bananas about plants. But only natives are given the chance to enter his five-acre Eden. And his is the most splendid and vibrant garden I've ever seen. Huge bushes of white poppies sway by the driveway. Scrappy evergreens screen out the neighboring house. A long arbor embroidered with morning glories banishes the sight of the neighbor's driveway. And a broad hillside reeking of natural resins and perfume tosses in the wind like an arid Monet painting that has blown to life. Dueling hummingbirds hurtle past my ear. Finches perch on dry flower stalks, picking out seeds. Bees whir. Ants stir. A bunny hops across the patch of grass at the top of the hill. Don can't stand still to let me admire it. "Excuse me while I get a weed," he mutters, and lurches into the shrubbery to uproot something. Then he heads down a skinny path that winds around his hill. He's a handsome, muscular guy, suited up for biking, and preconditioned with a smear of road rash under one knee. I have the impression he can't wait until I leave so he can go bouncing out through the land trust chaparral that carpets the surrounding hills. He's president of that land trust, and in addition to keeping his five-acre garden weed-free, he founded a community garden and native plants garden in the school system where he teaches. And he has a young family. "Watch your feet," Don says. "The harvester ants will bite you." I subject myself to the occasional bite, in exchange for having the San Diego horned lizard. That's all they eat. "Ooh, a native grass." He charges up the flowery slope to admire a volunteer. California grasses are surprisingly beleaguered. When Spanish cattle ranchers came through, they scattered European grass seeds to improve the grazing. The local grasses all but quit the field. "I never fertilize. Never, ever," Don says. We've reached the back of the house where some non-native grapes are being trained onto wire. Don has a small wine obsession, too. But his Syrah are organic, and they share their rows with wildflowers. "How about pests?" I ask. "There's such diversity of birds and other predators that nothing happens that doesn't take care of itself in a week or so." He has no use for pesticides, and scant use for water. "Just about everything is native, so it can pretty much survive on its own. I have to water the turf in front of the house. I have small kids, that's my excuse for now, and I occasionally water for fire prevention. You don't want things to get too crispy. Whoa, a whole bunch of weeds!" He makes a few other interventions. He thins the native chemise shrub, whose famously flammable wood can slingshot a wildfire through the suburbs. And he kills native gophers. He sets traps in their holes, and the cute little buggers instinctively try to block the light that enters through the trap. That triggers the snap. Whack! Left to their own devices, the gophers would eat the roots off the gorgeous manzanita bushes. One must choose. "When I catch one, I leave it for the coyotes and foxes," he says apologetically, "but the crows always get it." "Oops, I see a mustard." We've circled back to the colossal poppy bushes. I look over the chemical-free, waterless hillside that smells like heaven and is exploding with critters. All it requires is weeding and a touch of gopherside. It's ingenious. It ought to be. It took millions of years to perfect. Plant after plant, insect after insect, various species carved out a living on this part of the planet. The air grew hotter, and new plants evolved. The air grew cooler, and those plants were replaced by newer models. Animals that ate the old plants evolved into animals that ate the new ones. The soil evolved, changed by the plants and animals that lived upon it, by the gases and minerals that the rain and air carried through it. At this moment, the plants and animals living on Don's Hill are perfectly adapted to the soil. They get exactly as much water as they have evolved to need. They get precisely the amount of sunlight they've come to require. The soil pleases their palate perfectly. What a notion! What's the problem with foreign species? Certain friends ask me when I fume about the invaders. Aren't we foreign species, too? One problem is money. Invaders cost more than $123 billion a year in the United States, according to the calculations of Cornell ecologist Dave Pimentel. Some $29 billion is incurred by foreign weeds invading cropland, which results in herbicide treatments and crop losses. Another $6.5 billion comes from species like hawkweed and knapweed barging into grazing lands and gardens, displacing fodder and food. And that's only the plants. Rats, the Norway and the black, do $19 billion in damage each year, mainly by gobbling grains. Imported insects are good for $7 billion in destruction. The zebra mussel is at $3 billion and spreading fast. Bringing the problem right to the doorstep of grass farmers, Pimentel estimates that foreign insects cost U.S. lawn owners, gardeners, and golfers $1.5 billion every year. Another problem is biodiversity, whose dollar value can't be calculated. Invasive species are the top threat facing 42% of threatened and endangered species in the United States. A recent survey of the U.S. National Wildlife Refuge System found that 8 million acres of the system, intended to preserve native animals, are infested. About 500,000 acres, and growing, of federal wetlands have succumbed to the same purple loosestrife that brightens my neighbor's fence. What's the big deal about biodiversity? My devil's advocate friends ask. One answer is that complexity is healthy. Science is demonstrating that nature's intricate ecosystems, jammed with different life forms, tend to be resistant to disease and catastrophe. It's also showing that we're unable to restore those natural systems once they're out of whack. A man-made wetland may look good, but under the surface, there's nothing going on. Now, a devil might query, what has a diverse prairie or a bubbling wetland done for me lately? Scientists are just turning to the question of how much our own health and happiness depends on healthy ecosystems. Some impacts are obvious. It's hard to produce food in a world overrun by aggressive plants, and it's hard to hang on to that food if rats and starlings want it too. Other effects are subtle. For instance, Lyme disease is less likely to hop from an animal to a person in an ecosystem wealthy in small mammals. Another suggestion of diversity's value is that aspirin came from a willow tree, penicillin from a soil mold, and Taxol from the Pacific yew. If we let a few aggressive invaders drive the natives to extinction, we never know what curative chemicals they take with them. The biggest problem with invasives, though, is the hardest to argue. It has to do with how much a person values the way nature or God or fate set things up. Before we began shifting thousands of plants and animals around the planet, each little ecosystem evolved slowly. The ebb and flow of glaciers, along with the ticking of genetic mutations, the bobbing of driftwood-bearing lizards or beetles, and the crash of an occasional macrometeor. These accidents dictated the pace of change. The resulting ecosystems were fantastically complex, with each plant, animal, and bacterium holding an important position. I personally place a sky-high value on the way nature built the world. I think the homely St. John's wort is equal in value to the peregrine falcon. A leaf mold is as essential as a brook trout. It's too late to protect North America from the global species swap. Some 50,000 foreign species are already rearranging our ecosystems to suit themselves. Nonetheless, I think we should make every reasonable effort to protect what pockets of Americana remain. But that's just me. And speaking of me, am I an invasive, exotic species myself? Author David Quammen has called Homo sapiens a weedy species. But we're much more potent than a weed. Weeds have limits. Norway maples can't cut it in the jungle. Starlings can't make it on the tundra. We can. Furthermore, most weeds, be they furred, feathered, or foliated, need a ride, whether on a boat or driftwood or a hurricane wind, to their new territory. Homo sapiens just packs a dog and goes. We're a special case. We're the super invasive species. However, it seems to me that Homo sapiens belongs in the native category, based on the fact that people have been part of North American ecosystems for between 13,000 and 30,000 years. I personally, whose ancestors arrived only 350 years ago, am a funny question. Native with a wince, Josh Reut might say. Although I can cross-pollinate with the earlier installments of native Homo sapiens, my foliage betrays recent importation. But generally, people have been part of the North American plan for as long as woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers have been erased from it. That's native enough for me. Ditto for dogs, I suppose. Perhaps not ditto for cats, whom Europeans only recently carried to this continent, along with the invasive grasses, bittersweet, English sparrows, and apple trees. It's a swampy question, who belongs here and who doesn't. When I wrangle with friends, I end up arguing for what is practical, as opposed to what is ideal. Practically speaking, Homo sapiens has so thoroughly stirred the global pot of species that there's no avoiding our responsibility for the current arrangement. And that responsibility now entails deciding what stays and what goes, what is treasured, and what is too much trouble to save. In the democratic state of ecology, the entire populace decides how to arrange nature. It's one person, one vote. And bluebirds are not welcome at the polls. Chapter 12. Strange Family. Standing in snow at the back of the yard, I regard the only part of my yard I have yet to examine for wild birds, beasts, and plants. My house. It's a 1917 bungalow, built in an era when people were flowing out of the cities and spreading themselves more thinly across the landscape. Each family commandeered a greater patch of the earth's surface. In an apartment building in Portland, a 1917 family might have had 1,000 square feet of living space, sharing 1/10 of an acre of land on which their building stood. The family in my house expanded into 1,300 square feet. They alone had the use of 2/10 of an acre, 10 times more yard per family than they'd had in the city. From the back of my yard, the house looks like an island in nature, a vinyl-wrapped box with lines too straight to be nature-made. But no house, least of all one under my housekeeping regimen, is an island. Since mosquitoes aren't a problem in the daytime, I habitually leave my back door open on summer days, which is how Cheeky the chipmunk, multiple bumblebees, and even bagworms arrived in the kitchen. Even without the convenience of an open door, nature comes in. Too much of it, in the case of spiders and mice, and a truly biblical quantity of it, in the case of sow bugs. That's in addition to the microscopic residents of my house dust, who eat, breed, kill, and are killed without ever setting foot outside. exploiting the outer skin of my house are more critters, including the house finches who nested in a hanging plant on the porch this spring. That ended badly. So did the efforts of the wasps, although they put up a good fight. The house's impact on nature reaches even beyond its own walls, throwing rings of influence into the local habitat and out into the global environment. I slog forward through the snow, into the house's shadow, then into its protection. I'll start a census at the core and work my way outward. At least one more mammal is in my house than it was meant to accommodate. Since November, I've heard this animal at night, skittering through the living room ceiling, scuffling in the bedroom wall. In the basement, I've found caves excavated in the fiberglass insulation that I stuffed into the bigger holes. I'm grateful that the invader hasn't raided the kitchen. Still, whoever it is has got to go. I have my suspicions as to the identity. It sounds too small for a gray squirrel, and I've never seen a red squirrel in the yard. Besides, neither is nocturnal. Chipmunks rarely move into houses, and they, too, sleep at night. Mice don't. At the hardware store, I find mouse-size live traps. They look plausible, if barely. I buy two. Per directions, I flick a lump of peanut butter into the back, cock the trigger, and set each trap gently along the wall in the basement. Mice, like many wild animals, travel along edges where they can move easily but have quick access to cover. As for what I'll do with my captives, I remember how Chuck Lubelchick handled the mice he caught in the backyard last summer. He dumped the trap into a plastic bag, then restrained the mouse, threw the bag until he could grasp its tail. I can do that, then try to determine which species I'm dealing with. Well, I could do that if I had his traps, which, unlike mine, work. When I check my traps in the morning, it looks as though they've been kicked, punched, and bitten. One was mouse-handled until the peanut butter fell out. The other triggered prematurely, and the disappointed customer tried to gnaw his way in. I junk them and revert to the reliable snap trap. Later I'll read that when you live trap mice, you have to transport them to a different solar system if you don't want them to hop home again. Down here in the cellar, I've grown accustomed to the crackle of sow bugs underfoot. The first year I spent in this house, I was distressed by the army of isopods that emerged from the stone foundation in the spring and marched over the floor. I dread squishing bugs, and here were platoons of them, scudding across the cement like quarter-inch tanks. There was no discipline to the army's maneuvers. Some slid east to west, others slid north to south, and many found their way into stored teacups and baskets, saucepans and toolboxes. The whisper of their corpses has become the soundtrack for retrieving anything from the basement. The first year I tried shop-vacking them so I could walk to the washing machine without mashing a dozen. But as fast as I collected them, more appeared. Sow bugs can't survive freezing temperatures, so they have to spend the winter in a protected environment, such as the crevices of my foundation. Given the number of isopods on the floor, this knowledge gave me concern about the permeability of my foundation. It also made me wonder why the isopods don't just turn around in the spring and go out the way they came. Instead, they surge forward, where I suspect that those who aren't stepped on suffocate. Isopods are fundamentally sea creatures with gills and a powerful need for moisture. The best theory I can invent to explain the death march is that they're programmed to move toward warmth in the spring, and the inside of the basement is warmer than the outside. I've surrendered to the army now, and I don't try to avoid them. They die and dry out quickly anyway, becoming more crisp than squishy. Also down here in the basement are a handful of plants who crowd the windows in the summer like flowers in a hothouse. This gives me additional concern about the integrity of my foundation. One of the plants is a variegated border plant who lives in a flower garden on the other side of the window, so its roots must weave through the stone and mortar to establish new shoots inside the house. Another is a wild rose, and I have no idea where that came from. On the north side, where only weeds and moss grow outside the windows, it's weeds and moss who find their way in. Green velvet creeps over the masonry and windowsill. It's beautiful, and probably happy to lead such a sheltered life. A bittersweet vine, bane of my existence, has breached the window by the stairs. I expect its botanical mandate is to ascend and strangle me in my bed. Among the other cellar citizens, the fungi are most prominent. This time of year, they're dormant, resting in the spore phase. But when the earth's moisture suffuses the basement in a few months, a fungal frenzy will ensue. Under every cardboard box, colonies will thrive. Thready hyphae will probe through the cardboard and up into the stored books, feeling their way between pages, devouring pulp and print. Fruiting bodies will release spores into the cellar air, and fresh empires will bloom on the backpack, the wetsuit, the old rocking chair. The odor of fungal exhalations and decomposing fungi will rise and form a cloud that waits behind the door to the kitchen. It's no fun conducting a census of the basement. It's dim. Obviously, it's about as energy efficient as a tent, and I'm reminded for the zillionth time that there's no room to move my books upstairs. Bungalows, built in a simpler time, are a storage nightmare in the material age. And with regard to the leakiness, it occurs to me that mice are getting in through holes substantially larger than those required by sow bugs. True, mice can squirt themselves through a gap about the width of a ballpoint pen, but cold air can squeeze through even easier. Wishing my new mousetraps luck, I flee. Upstairs, the population of houseflies, spiders, and assorted insects has diminished along with the temperature. The flies wedged in the cracks around the windows, hoping, like the sow bugs, to benefit from my reliance on fossil fuels. The other day I found a ladybug snoring in my sock drawer. Even the fruit flies are gone from the airspace over the compost bucket on the counter. Their larvae are spending the winter outside, under a few inches of soil. Come spring, they won't need an open door to resume their vigil. The scent of alcohol released by decomposing fruit will lead them right through the window screens. The pantry moths, too, are blessedly absent. I think I destroyed their habitat, but I understand they sometimes lie low for the winter, even indoors. They could flutter back into my life after a few months. I've never dealt with them before this autumn, and I hope never to encounter them again. Their eggs or larvae come home in an infested grocery item. Once hatched, they must have battered around the cabinet at night, laying as many as 400 minuscule eggs apiece. It wasn't until adult moths constituted an indoor snow flurry that I realized something had gone awry with the provisions. By then, the larvae had penetrated everything. A factory-sealed bag of pecans, when I opened it, was a shivering, webby mass of nuts, worm, and their chaff. A twist-tied bag of couscous featured some couscouses that squirmed. A screw-top jar of cornmeal, when shaken, revealed clumps of meal bound with white silk. Gack! Everything went outdoors to the compost bin. I scrubbed the cabinets and grabbed the clumsy moths out of the air. And as I replaced flowers and grains, the food went in the fridge. No moths have bobbled across my horizon for a few months now, but like flea larvae, these insects can stretch their life cycle in lean times. They could be in there just waiting for a bag of rice. The greatest diversity of my housemates probably inhabits the house dust ecosystem. Having researched the world of microscopic mites and microbes and pseudoscorpions for a previous book, I know their natural history well. Even so, I find them hard to believe in, due to their smallness. Returning my disregard, the plants and animals exploit strips of habitat between the floorboards, expanses of shelter in the rugs and couch cushions, and the cavey innards of the mattresses upstairs. Bacteria and fungi grow like grass on a thin soil composed of my copious skin sheddings, newspaper fibers, and towel lint. Grazing on the grass are dust mites and silverfish. The most famous dust mite also devours my skin, raking spit-softened tissue into a body so simplified it lacks even a head. And preying on the grazers are ruthless carnivores. Predatory mites lurk between rug fibers waiting for an eyeless, headless mite to trundle past. They stab their quarry, then drink them dry. Between books or under the table leg sit crab-like pseudo-scorpions with mite-crushing claws. It's impossible to construe my house as an island in nature when there's a Serengeti under my sofa and a river of mite blood flowing between the banks of the maple boards. Among all the other oddities that come and go through my house, I'm unable to forget the pearlescent egg I carried indoors in the summer. I had found it attached to a pine needle. It was the size of a sesame seed, and beneath the surface I could see two black eye spots. I hoped to see more under the microscope, but I set it in a jar lid on my office windowsill and got distracted. Next thing I knew, I had propped my feet on the windowsill and flipped the lid. I searched high and low and couldn't find the pearl. Perhaps it hatched and departed through the screen to pursue its destiny. Perhaps I ran over it with my chair. Maybe it's charting new territory for its species, traveling the innards of my computer. Those black eyes haunt me. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.